Three fantastic speakers here today. The first is Alan Judd, a novelist and biographer who served in the Army and the Foreign Office. And he's in that famous grant a picture of the best 20 young novelists 40 years ago in 1983. He's completely unchanged today. His novels have won the Winifred Holtby Award, the Heinemann Award, and the Guardian Fiction Award. But much more important than that, he's the Oldies motoring correspondent. And his new brilliant spy thriller is Queen and Country, Alan Judd.
Well, thank you, and thank you for coming today. All right, spy novels. Potted history, spy novels, yes?
Yep.
Started mainly in the late 19th century, and oddly, they started in this country. It has become a sort of British-dominated tradition, although plenty of other countries do it as well. Up to the First World War, there was a huge number of spy novels and spy stories in the papers. And there were writers such as William Le Queux, who was horrifyingly prolific. He could write and publish six novels in a year. He did over 100 altogether. They are so bad that they're worth reading. Let me just read you an example from the wine-soaked list that I've got here. Le Queux wasn't the only one. There was a man called Edward Oppenheimer, Philip Oppenheimer, over 100 novels and 39 volumes of short stories. They contributed to a huge spy scare before the First World War. Attlee had to deny in Parliament that there were 66,000 German waiters and hairdressers in this country who were secretly reservists who were waiting for the call on the day, der Tag, to take up arms from a secret arsenal within a quarter mile of Charing Cross, probably beneath the National Liberal Club. Of course, he denied it in Parliament. There was no evidence of it. His denial was never believed, because prime ministerial denials never are. Now, during the First World War, there was plenty of scope for spy writing, and two distinct themes or branches of it developed. One is the adventurous thing that, you know, with Richard Hannay and people like that, where you have bold, usually male adventurers going out, bashing the enemy, basically, and winning through. And that, you know, culminates in the James Bond, the Fleming James Bond edition. Then you have the more internal and murky world of compromise, moral and otherwise, that was started in a way by Somerset Maugham in his Ashendon Papers, which are the most realistic spy fiction, I think. They are worth reading if you ever get to them. I'll just read you this example of Le Queux's writing. Okay. "I wish for that tracing," I said, whipping out the revolver I always carried. "Give it to me." "What next?" he laughed in open defiance. "Who are you, a mere servant, that you should dictate to me?" "I am an Englishman," I replied. And so they go on. Okay, so leap forward a few decades, and we're up to Le Carré and Fleming, and I think those two epitomise the different strands of spy writing. I never met Ian Fleming. I did know John Le Carré over a period of about 25 years, and I admire greatly what he did. He created a world which we instantly recognise. If you say it's Le Carré-esque, it's as recognisable as saying it is Dickensian, it is Greenian, it is Kafkaesque. And that is a huge achievement. But, I think there is a but here, but Le Carré was a romantic. He romanticised the world of spying and spy literature just as much as Fleming did, but in another direction. Although he wouldn't like to admit that that's what he was doing, that is what he was doing. Actually, no intelligence service could function as they are in Le Carré's books, in reality. The way people treat each other, the way that nearly everyone is betraying everyone else at some point or another, overlooks the fact that actually the characteristics of intelligence services, at least in this country, are overwhelmingly loyalty and work and a sense of humour. Also, you don't get much humour in spire writing generally. There are exceptions, but you don't get any in Le Carré, for example. Not really. Now, if you try to set spy writing and spy literature in its context, you have to put it in a political context and on a personal level in a personal context. Spies are us. They are ordinary people. They're people like us. They have private lives. They have the usual concerns. They have emotional lives. When I wrote the first of the six spy novels I've done, about, I counted my novels before this talk, actually, and to my surprise, I found I've perpetrated 16 upon an unoffending public, of which six are the Charles Thorogood spy series. And I started them with one called Legacy, and I wanted in Legacy to do a deliberately, as it were, un-Le Carré novel, a novel that shows that people, as I say, have private lives, their work impinges on their private lives with consequences, and also that they have a political context, a wider context. And so that's what I did with Legacy. I thought that would be my only spy novel. I never intended any of these Charles Thorogood spy novels to have a successor, which is why, if you carefully work out the chronology of them, Charles Thorogood is actually about 116 now. And at one point, I made him chief, because I thought this would be the last of the series, you know, the last one, so he can be chief of MI6. Well, the trouble is with chiefs of MI6 is they don't do anything like very much. I mean, they go to meetings and they read things. But readers of spy novels actually want things to happen. They want action, incident, character, humour. So you have to be a bit unrealistic in getting the chief engaged as he is in this latest one. He's in retirement and he's brought back to ask to conduct an operation he doesn't really believe should happen or has any chance of success. But out of a sense of old loyalties, he does it. And the great thing about Mr. Putin, of course, is that he's made it possible to go on writing Cold War spy novels. Because before that, you know, people were having to find other subjects, you know. But now, you can go on doing it, thanks to him. So that's what I've attempted with this series. Now, should they go on? Will there be another Charles Thorogood spy novel? Well, I really haven't decided yet. The next one I'm thinking of, actually, as a novel, is about a lady called Afra Behn. Hands up who has heard of Afra Behn. Good. The word is spreading. Afra Behn was a 17th century Restoration playwright. Her date was 1640 to 1689. She was one of the most successful, from Canterbury, quite right, born Afra Johnson. She was one of the most successful playwrights of her time, and she's believed to be the first British woman, and maybe the first anywhere, I don't know, to have made her living entirely from her pen. She's buried in Westminster Abbey, surprisingly, and she was also a documented spy. Her reports and her letters are in the National Archive, where you can go and look them up. So I have undertaken to do a novel about her, but whether it's more a novel about her that features spying, or whether it's a spy novel in the sense that, you know, the essence of the whole thing is the spying plot, rather than spying is something that's going on at the same time as everything else, I haven't yet decided. The last but one before I did this book was about Christopher Marlowe, who was another spy, for which there's good evidence and no proof, as there is with Afra Behn. But there's good evidence. But for 40 years I wanted to write a novel about Christopher Marlowe and eventually found a way of doing it, I hope, anyway. But I used the spying as a way into his life rather than it being just about the spying. My heart always sinks when someone stands up to speak and obviously have papers in their hand and is going to go on and on and on as they read. But I'd like to just read you a couple of short paragraphs and see what you think. The rain had just begun to fall on the cobblestone streets of Prague, casting a shimmering sheen upon the ancient city's worn facade. The air was thick with the scent of wet stone and old secrets, and in the distance the haunting strains of a melancholic violin drifted through the mist. It was a city steeped in history where every building seemed to hold a thousand untold tales, and where shadows danced upon the walls like spectres of the past. In a dimly lit corner of a hidden cafe, a man sat alone, his face obscured by the brim of a weathered fedora. His sharp, calculating eyes surveyed the room with a practiced ease, never lingering too long on any one person or object. He exuded an air of quiet intensity, a sense that beneath the unassuming exterior lay a mind honed by years of clandestine operations. Now, is that the start of Queen and Country? Well, could it be? Well, I'll tell you what it is. I was given it last night by a friend who read it out to me and said, there's much more of it than that. Who do you think wrote this? And I thought, well, no, it's not Le Carré, it's not Fleming, it's too florid for either of those. Too many adjectives, too much scene setting. Who could it be? I said, could it be Ambler? Eric Ambler, 1930s, sort of Bravi, Signorini, was keen on all that. And then, rather to my horror, my friend said, I've put it into ChatGPT, and I said, tell a spy story in the manner of Alan Judd. Well, I hope that's not how I write, but actually it's not a bad beginning. And I suspect the algorithm was looking more at spy literature, spy writing, than it was at Judd in particular. But if it hones in on Judd, I don't see any reason why my next novel couldn't be done entirely by it. And then I could send it off to my publishers, pretending I'd written it, and, you know, all would be well, or would it? But anyway, I think it's pretty frightening. You might try the similar experiments yourselves, if you haven't already. So, on that note, I shall shut up before something that is not me takes over and talks all sorts of nonsense. Thank you.